From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Jonathan Gray. He joins us with his thoughts on ancient high technology. He says it disappeared thousands of years ago. Where is it? We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about, were we seeded by extraterrestrials? By the way, if you have a computer, you might want to get up to weatherunderground.com. Just take a look at how I've been getting pelted here in the cave in St. Louis. I'm here for two more weeks, then it's back to Los Angeles. But go to weatherunderground.com, click on the map of Missouri, and then scroll down where you get to the St. Louis portion and look under local radar. We have had severe storms busting through here. And I wasn't quite so sure that the things would hold up. We've got some backup generators here, and I was thinking, uh-oh, now we're going to test them. We're going to have to kick them in. But so far, everything is okay. Meanwhile, the Atlantic hurricane season is still 2 weeks away, but the first hurricane of the season in the Pacific is taking a very unusual path toward the Caribbean. The Atlantic season officially begins on June 1st. But this sneak peek of storm season is a reminder that Florida may be in for another busy year. Now, Adrian strengthened into a hurricane and moved closer to Central America. Outer rain bands are already reaching the coasts of El Salvador and Guatemala. The government of Guatemala and El Salvador issued a hurricane warning for the Pacific coast. A tropical storm watch is in effect for the Pacific coast of Honduras. Government officials are issuing evacuation orders as we speak to residents as the storm approaches. December's Great Sumatra Earthquake, the most powerful in more than 40 years and the trigger of a devastating tsunami, shook the ground everywhere on Earth's surface, they say. Weeks later, the planet was still trembling. The quake resulted from the longest fault rupture ever observed, 720 miles to 780 miles, and it spread for 10 minutes, also a record. A typical earthquake's duration would be 30 seconds, so just understand that. The December quake was the first of its size to be measured and studied by the new worldwide array of digital seismic instruments. Those results are starting to come in now with a special section of a half a dozen research papers on the quake appearing in Friday's issue of the journal Science. The earthquake and the resulting tsunami, which swept across the Indian Ocean, killed more than 176,000 people in 11 countries, left about 50,000 missing and hundreds of thousands homeless. That number, of course, I believe is low. The quake occurred where two of the giant plates that form the surface of the planet grind together. A Russian village has been baffled after its lake disappeared overnight. Now, this happened a year ago in Lake Chesterfield in the St. Louis area. NTV television showed pictures of a giant muddy hole bathed in summer sun while fishermen from the village looked on, couldn't believe it. They said it is very dangerous. If a person had been in this area, he would have been sucked right in. There would have been no chance of survival. Just what happened? Well, they think the water went into some kind of underground water course or cave system. Some villagers, though, have an even more sinister explanation. We get blamed, by the way, in this country for everything. This is what they say out there in this Russian village. I'm thinking America has finally got to us. That's what they believe. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Hassan Rouhani, stated that the decision to resume nuclear activities at the country's Isfahan facility has been made and it is irreversible. This comes a week after the European Union's warning that negotiations would cease and the UN Security Council action would be taken if Iran were to resume its enrichment of uranium. Meanwhile, the EU3, which is France, Germany, and Britain, has called for a crisis meeting with Iran on March 23rd upon learning of Tehran's announcement to resume the uranium enrichment program. Two people in Louisiana were riding in a hot air balloon. They were killed when they either fell out or jumped after it reportedly hit at least one power line and caught on fire. The debris stretched for quite a distance. Bill Harwell, a 52-year-old man who owned the balloon, and Sandy DeMoss, 54, were killed in that crash. Think about this for a moment. A personal flying machine designed for commuting, reaching speeds of up to 55 miles an hour, does not require a license to fly. It has a single seat, a four-stroke engine, is barely 10 feet tall, and will be sold soon. In a moment, inventor Elwood Woody Norris, our guest this hour on Coast to Coast AM.
This hour of Coast to Coast AM is brought to you by United Healthcare. It just makes sense.
Well, his name is Elwood Woody Norris, widely recognized as a very prolific inventor and talented technology integrator. In 1956, he joined the U.S. Air Force and was trained as a nuclear weapons specialist and took electronics courses at the University of New Mexico. After his honorable discharge in 1959, Mr. Norris began employment at the University of Washington, where he became director of the Engineering Experiment Station for that campus. Woody holds, listen to this, 47 U.S. patents and more than 100 patents worldwide. He is the chairman of American Technology Corporation in California, and he just won the Inventor's Nobel Prize for his hypersonic sound system, the $500,000 annual Lemison MIT Prize, an award coveted by investors and inventors alike. Woody also invented a flying car that works, simple to fly, will soon be available to you and will now be affordable. We're going to talk with him about the car and, of course, about the hypersonic sound system now on Coast to Coast. Hello, Woody. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing, George?
Always a pleasure. Well, you must have a brain that never stops.
Well, my wife wouldn't agree with that. Sometimes I wonder if it ever kicks into the proper gear.
How did you get so technologically minded? How did that happen?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not your typical inventor in that I don't fit the pattern very good. I'm pretty much lazy, probably watch more TV than I should, but I also am an avid reader of technical journals. Of course, the internet has helped that too. You can pretty much find out anything you want to on the internet. But
sure.
I didn't get my education in the regular way. I think I got educated, but I didn't get it sitting in a university class. I'm a dropout.
So you got it from the School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah, the School of Hard Knocks and of necessity.
All right, now let's talk a little bit about this air scooter. Tell me about this thing.
Well, a friend and I came up with the idea originally because we were looking for what is the next invention we ought to work on together. He's a good friend of mine who kind of helps finance a lot of the things I do. And I said, you know what? I have a pilot's license, but I hate flying in a private plane. I always feel like I'm in a soapbox derby. They're rickety.
Yeah.
So what don't I like about regular airplanes is the way it started. I don't like having to be going 100 miles an hour to stay in the air. I don't like having to go to the airport to be able to fly, and it sort of went from there. And it then devolved into, okay, I need a rotorcraft. What's the problem with a conventional rotorcraft helicopter? First of all, it costs about $50,000 in training to learn how to fly one. Our air scooter sells for about $47,000, and it's not a kit, it's fully assembled, and you don't need to be trained in a sense that you don't need to spend that $50,000. We train you, takes maybe a weekend, depends on the average person, and you're a pilot.
I've been looking at the picture of the air scooter on your website, and all these websites that are associated to Woody are located on the coasttocoastam.com website now, linked up with his name. How high can this air scooter go, Woody?
Well, we don't recommend that you fly 10,000 feet, but if you live in Denver, you're already a mile up. And so, in fact, it's capable of going about that high, but the recommendation is you stay out of the traffic that's up there in the sky. All you want to really do is get out of the traffic down here.
Well, now, is this scooter, is it a plane? Is it a flying car? What the heck is it?
Well, looking at the website, you can kind of tell. And by the way, if you dig a little bit, there's actually a video on there of it flying. It's a rotorcraft like a helicopter, but it looks kind of bizarre. And if you know much about the history of helicopters, it goes back to the earliest Sikorsky, in a sense, that had twin rotating blades that went in opposite directions. And early on in the history of commercial helicopters, they abandoned that approach because you had to use the throttle either to go up and down, or the linkages got very, very complicated with two sets of blades. And so maintenance was a huge issue.
Okay, some people who haven't had the ability to go to their computer yet and taken a look at this or even looked at the video, those of us who are here right now, people driving in their cars and trucks, people who are just at home listening on their radio, tell us a little bit of how this works. Somebody gets in, they sit in the seat. What do they do? Turn a key? How does it get going?
You have an electric starter. That's part of it. And to qualify, by the way, under this Part 103 of the FAA regulations, which is where all the hang gliders and paragliders and powered parachutes mm-hmm. fit into that classification, it's very strict requirements. It has to weigh, without any safety equipment, under 254 pounds, dry, no gas, okay. no oil. This thing meets that qualification. It has some safety equipment added. It, first of all, you notice, unlike a regular helicopter, it doesn't have a tail rotor. You get away from that by essentially moving the tail rotor over your head with the conventional rotor that's already up there, and they go in opposite directions. They're tilted in such a way that they complement each other. And so one thing happens immediately is they neutralize all the gyroscopic effects that you get on a regular helicopter. So when you push the stick forward, in this case it's a handlebar, not all those kind of controls you've got on a regular helicopter. When you push it forward, you go forward. When you pull it backwards, you go backwards. None of this counterintuitive, very complicated stuff that you have to learn when you're flying a regular helicopter.
Do you take off like a helicopter?
I mean, go straight up and hover. I'm telling you, it's like defying gravity the first time you do it, even a foot off the ground. Now, get this. When you're up in the air, I weigh about 220 pounds. The craft weighs under 300 pounds, as I said. The blades are only going about 800 RPM, so you don't have this screaming sound above your head. That's pretty slow rotation. That's about idle for a car as far as the equivalence in the amount of movement the blades are doing.
What's the fuel, Woody? Is it gasoline?
Plain old gasoline.
What's the octane? Does it matter?
87? Usually premium. Now, again,
93. All right.
Yeah, this thing was made deliberately with the idea to get around all the things I hated about flying a private plane. Fly it out of your backyard. You know, if you live in New York City, in 10 minutes in any direction, pretty much, you're out in the boonies. You can fly.
I got to tell you, I live in Los Angeles 80% of the time. We all know what the traffic is like that. Are you saying that I could get up, get into this thing, pass all the traffic I want, maybe even move right along the freeway, but just hover above bridges, let's say?
Well, let me tell you, I don't know if you saw the thing about 3 weeks ago on 60 Minutes, but a little revelation came to me watching it, which I was unaware of. NASA has basically come up with a computer program designed for this kind of a craft, not for commercial airplanes, and they call it the Highway in the Sky. And the idea is a fairly simple computer program with a little viewing device on your dashboard or by your handlebar in this case, and it maps out visually a horizon and a equivalent of a freeway. And you fly along this thing, so you don't need to have all this training that is so complex when you ever looked inside of the cockpit of a regular airplane.
All right, Woody, I got to ask you this, though. What's the downside? I mean, can this thing crash? What happens?
Well, anything can crash, but if you keep the thing at a modest altitude, it's got enough inertia in the two sets of blades to settle to the ground. We also put, as a safety equipment, a set of rubber pontoons on it. You see that, again, if you get out of your car and go to a website for those listening. And it'll give you a cushioned landing. Also, by the way, it lands on water. And so
that's a good idea.
Yeah. Now, you know, anything can be deliberately crashed into a building or into a wall. but because you have control over it with this handlebar, no foot pedals, none of the stick or collective type interactive stuff you have to deal with on a regular helicopter, you're not preoccupied with all kinds of things in order to keep this thing flying straight and level.
Are there weather conditions, Woody, that you wouldn't go up in, even, let's say, 200, 300 feet?
Oh, I think so, sure. It's like, you know, I've sat on the runway on major airlines for a couple of hours in Texas in a jet because of a weather. And so you got to have common sense. By the way, the FAA regulates under Part 103 that this is for daylight flight, at least right now. They also regulate the speed. The 55 miles an hour, I believe, is the speed that was in fact set by the FAA.
Of course, when you're just going in a relatively straight line to someplace, I mean, that cuts a lot of time down.
Imagine
55 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah, and imagine you put a little GPS on this thing. You put a little dot where you start from, go anywhere you want, and you can make a beeline back to your starting point. You don't have to worry about getting lost.
Would you do that for us? Would you put the GPS unit in
there? Oh, yeah. We're looking, in fact, at all kinds of options. Interestingly, our original idea for this was strictly for fun and for civilians. All of a sudden now there's things like lifeguards. I mean, much easier to go out and rescue some. Imagine, I see this every year on TV in the winter when the ponds are frozen over and somebody fell through the ice. And they're trying to chip through with their oars with a couple of guys in a canoe.
Or they're on their belly and they're sliding across the ice to get
to
them.
Or on a roof of a house where there's a flooding situation. Go out, pick them up, take them ashore, or throw them a line. I mean, infinitely better than having to be stuck on terra firma in situations like that and try and rescue somebody.
Can you get the price down from $47,000 to 20-some thousand?
Yeah, we think we believe that when we get our production levels up to substantial numbers, that, like everything else, the price on this thing will be significantly less. But think of this. That price is less than you pay to get a license to fly a regular helicopter.
And what kind of training do you need before you can go up?
We give you training. It takes most people. In fact, the thing we did on 60 Minutes, Bob Simon, the host, was ready in 5 minutes. Ten tries.
Okay, so you're in California. How close are you to Los Angeles?
I'm in San Diego, so it's just a couple hours. But we also have a facility in Nevada. We build these in Texas. And we'll probably have a facility for training in Florida before the end of the year is our hope.
Maybe I'll go up in one with a tape recorder and then play the whole thing on Coast to Coast one day.
Yeah, easily. Easily done. I want to tell you, this is as close to anti-gravity as you'll get. And it's not a pipe dream. This isn't some idea that's 30 years away. It's now.
Okay, so I'm up, let's say, 150 feet, 200 feet. What do you recommend for the real height on one of these
things? I say just get over the trees. I believe the FAA says if you stay under 400 feet, you're pretty much safe to fly anywhere except over a military base or a regular airfield.
Okay, so let's say we're at 300 feet, size of a football field. At worst, the engine's cut off. Am I going to just, like, gyro down? I'll be okay?
Well, at that height, it might be a little marginal. But we also have some safety equipment. You've got options to buy parachutes. We're even looking at maybe putting airbags on these things. So that
who would not want to take that option?
That's right. I think you're exactly right.
I mean, you would do that. What about the possibility of having like those big round balls that would pop up like they use for the Mars rover when they landed on Mars?
Let me just tell you, we have explored every conceivable idea. I'll tell you a wacky one we came up with. You talk about airbags in a car. The chemicals that drive the airbag to inflation act in a few thousandths of a second and could create the equivalence of a tremendous amount of pressure in an air tank. And with an air motor like the mechanic uses to put the lug nuts on your car, a lightweight air motor could get you down from that kind of a height pretty easy. And that's one of the things we've looked at.
How close is this to getting to the market, Woody?
We hope to have this out without all the options that I talked about, but the basic unit.
Oh, no, I want all the options. I want them all.
Those are pretty easy because they're most, except for maybe the one I just mentioned, they're pretty much off the shelf. But we're looking to get it out sometime later this year.
Okay, where do I park it? I land on my building in L.A. What do I do? Just keep it up there on the roof or what?
Well, if you like to, you can take the blades off in about 10 minutes and pull it in your garage on a small little adapter that comes, you know, is an option. Fit it on a very small little trailer that holds Sea-Doos or a motorcycle. Push it into your garage. Well, we've trucked this thing around the country in the back of a rental U-Haul.
Okay. Have you had any dangerous problems at all when you were building this?
The reason we're not selling today is that the engine, which is critical to this, is a kind of a new engine. We couldn't find a four-stroke engine that was light enough in weight to fit the bill. Four-stroke engines, usually heavier. You want to get lightweight, you go to a two-stroke. And I was personally dead set against a two-stroke engine. Two-stroke, lightweight, you don't have valves, you don't have half the parts that you have on a regular car engine.
That's true.
I'll tell you about the four-stroke engine maybe after the break. It sounds like it's coming up.
It is. You got that right, Mr. Inventor. Woody, when we come back as well, we'll talk about the engine. We'll finish up talking about the air scooter. Then we've got to talk about your hypersonic sound system. This is unbelievable. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Okay, now make sure you're part of the After Dark newsletter group because the June issue is a special UFO edition. Next week, by the way, we've got an entire week of very strange stories for you and guests. You're gonna love it. But this UFO edition highlights on a number of topics, including what could very well be an alien hybrid down there in Mexico. Some say it's a kid who's a reptilian. Read all about it in the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by dialing this toll-free number, 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online, coasttocoastam.com. And at the top of the hour, of course, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Gray about ancient technology, and he believes they had some incredible things. Nope, they didn't have the air scooter, but they might have had flying machines anyway. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest this hour, Woody Norris, inventor. And Woody, though the air scooter may be one heck of a machine, you're going to need to get a bigger server on that website. I think we cooked it.
I don't doubt it. I think you've got lots of listeners.
Yeah, we sure do. Now, let's finish up talking about this four-stroke engine.
Well, the problem I had was unwilling to use a two-stroke engine. problem with a two-stroke, and I'll use it as an analogy, is to get any real horsepower out of them, they got to go 6,000 to 10,000 RPM. When you slow the engine down, the inertia keeps the piston going up and down, no oil being injected because, you know, the oil and the fuel are all mixed, so the thing can seize up and you're dead. So the idea initially had to be four-stroke engine like you have in a car.
Yes.
Typically, they're heavier, and so we couldn't find a lightweight one. We couldn't find anyone who would sell us one that we could try and make it into a lightweight engine.
Not even ceramic?
Well, who made one that we could get? So what we did is went to New Zealand, found a small company over there that hand-built racing engines for motorcycles for probably 20 years. And the engine was heavy, but we made a deal with them, and we gave them a bunch of money and also put some engineering effort on our side to make it into the first really lightweight four-stroke engine. Got rid of the steel crankcase, made it aluminum, titanium crankshaft, lined the interior of it with ceramic, cooled the internal engine with a mix of air and oil. I mean, it just has all kinds of features that you just don't see on a conventional engine. It also has some aspects to it that you would expect to find on a two-stroke.
Have you been able to arrange bank financing yet for people when this when you decide to get this to the market?
Well, so far, that hasn't been a question that's come from the more than 1,000 people that have contacted us who want to buy these things. But, you know, GE Finance, Bank of America, I used to own a hi-fi store years ago, and these companies that will carry the contract for you, whether you're a furniture store or you make air scooters, line up to get your business for that.
Absolutely, because, you know, not everybody can write you a check for $25,000 to $47,000.
Yeah, so that's an easy solution, and I don't see that being a barrier at all.
Well, good luck with it. I got to tell you, I'm very, very curious, and may very well take you up on an offer to sit down on one of these things and go up a little bit, okay?
It's a blast, I just tell you. It's a blast.
Just make sure I come down safely, okay, Woody?
Well, you start off, stay up about a foot or two till you really get some comfort in your own ability.
I think I could handle that.
And then if you fall 5 or 10 feet, you're just going to bounce.
All right, now, Mr. Inventor, tell me about the hypersonic sound system. What is that?
Well, I've always been interested in stereo, hi-fi. And when I started off as a kid, the weak link on listening to music was on both ends. The turntable or the tape was terrible, hissy, lousy quality. And, of course, on the opposite end, the loudspeaker is like a mechanical piston that pumps back and forth and beats against the air. Well, we improved the one end. We got digital storage with CDs and DVDs. We now got solid-state electronics, but the same old loudspeaker that's been around for pretty much 80 years this year. A cone that pumps back and forth and beats against the air. My idea was to get rid of that, and I just did some free thinking, brainstorming, and I said, okay, let's see. Why not make the sound right in the air without a speaker? And
oh,
so
really?
That was the inspiration. It was pretty tough.
So how do you do that?
Well, when you watch TV, here's how I invent. I have, as you say, 47 U.S. patents. Actually, it turns out more than 300 international patents that correspond to those. But when you invent, I invent by finding an analogy to what I want to do in a different field. So let's look at TV for a minute. When you watch TV, you see thousands, if not millions, of colors. And we all know that there's only three colors on the screen at any given time.
That's true.
The primary red, green, blue, RGB. What you do is you mix them and make new ones. In electronic circuits, this is a different realm now, another analogy. You mix electronic signals and come up with new signals. When an artist is painting a canvas, he takes a palette with maybe 6 or 8 colors on it and stirs them around together, gets as many colors as he can think of. So I thought, why can't you mix sound and make new sound? Step one. Here's step two. Instead of just mixing sound you can hear, let's shift up into the ultrasonic range and mix a couple of ultrasonic frequencies. Say, for instance, 50,000 cycles and 51,000 cycles. If you could somehow cause them to mix in the air, the difference between the two, which is 1,000, would magically appear in the air. And voila, it works.
Can you imagine, Woody, the applications for this?
Well, first of all, the conventional loudspeaker, start there. 14 billion of them sell every year. and then take all the applications where if you could do the other things that came on as byproducts to hypersonic sound that nobody ever thought of with a regular speaker. I mean, for instance, projecting sound like a beam of light. Because it's created using ultrasound, which tends to beam and be very narrow and tight, and the sound that you're hearing is made within that tight beam, it takes on that nature, which is completely out of character for sound. Nobody ever thought you could focus regular sound. I mean, if you talk and you turn around in a circle, someone standing next to you still hears your voice. You don't have to aim right at their head when you talk. That's what happens with sound. But that's totally different than hypersonic sound. I aim this at you, and you hear it, and a guy standing a couple of feet away hears
doesn't hear it at
nothing.
All. Nothing. Okay, so, for example, you could put this up on a something, let's say a kiosk in a mall.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe you're selling, I don't know, watches or something.
A rack of clothing or in a supermarket, a box of cornflakes.
Yeah. So you walk by and the sign says, hey, you with a lousy watch. And you turn around and look at it and it invites you over, sort of.
Exactly. The other thing we like to say is we create silence as much as we make sound, so that if you're in the vicinity of this and you're talking to a friend and you don't want to be disrupted, take one step to the side, you don't hear it. Now, let's talk about another neat application, though. We all are interested in home theater. And, you know, nowadays it's not just speakers in the front. It's surround sound.
Exactly.
Side walls, back walls. Imagine you could project this to a side wall, which we do every day, and it bounces off the wall, and the wall is a speaker. The same as if, again, I would shine a light on the wall. And you're in the room, and you see that little circle there where the brightness is, representing the light I'm shining on the wall. And think of this, too. When you move around the room after I've put the light at a certain spot, it doesn't shift position. It stays there.
It's there all the time until you change that.
Yeah, so put it on that spot on the wall, and everyone in the room hears the sound coming as a surround channel from that spot. Now, when you sit in a movie theater today or in your home theater, you got to sit in the sweet spot or you don't get that effect.
That's exactly right.
Because it's imaginary, the positioning. It's because of interaction between multiple speakers rather than actual sound coming from that location.
What would this do to communications, let's say military applications?
Oh, well, let's get really mundane then, go to military. How about a lifeguard that wants to tell one person on the beach you're in a restricted area and he's the only one that can hear it? Or a coach wants to talk to his quarterback? Or a fireman wants to tell somebody on the 10th floor, don't jump, we're putting up a net. And by the way, another virtue popped out of this, which is because the sound isn't made at one point like it is with a regular loudspeaker, but an infinite number of points along this column, it carries about 100 times further for any given level than a regular loudspeaker before it drops off in level.
And what's the quality of sound like, Woody?
Unbelievable. You have no box. No woofers, no tweeters, no crossover networks, no magnets. Think of this. You got rid of the mechanical part, the weak part of the loudspeaker, and you're making the sound in the air. It has got to be experienced. In fact, I talked about when you point it to a person, the sound you hear when I aim it directly towards you that you experience is made right next to your ears. And so it's not like you're hearing sound come from a distance. It's like it's being made right next to your head, and the most recent, most immediate comment everyone makes is, you slapped a pair of headphones on me, but there's nothing on my head.
How would they use this in a concert?
Imagine you're sitting in the back row, and now you're getting the same level as the front row. And I need to point out, just like a beam of light can be focused tight, we can spread this out so you cover a specific size audience.
One person, let's say, or you
or
can
the
get
whole audience.
Or the whole audience.
And also imagine, you know how I went to a Sheryl Crow concert recently, and at the end when the crescendo was building up, they're shining, sweeping all these lights over the audience to build the emotion. Imagine sweeping the drum or the saxophone or the bass guitar all over the audience, and it's moving over everyone's head. It's just a whole new level of stuff we can do with sound. And in a way, it's kind of embarrassing. It's taken 80 years to come up with this.
Well, I was going to say, why did it take so long? Why did Woody Norris, the inventor, come up with this in the year 2000, what, four, five? When
well,
did you do this?
It's been about 8 years. I'll tell you how it happens. Most people, when they get too much education, get a bunch of blinders put on. A real inventor is a combination of as much education as you can get, but you got to be a certain amount of stupid, or at least willingness to try stuff that other people know better than, and often you'll just stumble onto things. I didn't know better. I didn't know it couldn't be done.
So when are you going to invent alternative energy for us?
I'm working on it. Believe me.
You just may pull this off.
And believe me, my friend and I are spending our own money.
Well, let me tell you something. As a friend who doesn't know you, be very careful. We have had a guest on the Coast to Coast who was murdered a year ago. He was working on cold fusion. They still can't find out who killed him or why.
Oh, my gosh. Well,
I have my suspicions, Woody. There are a lot of big boys out there who do not want to see alternative energy. Just
well,
be careful.
Of course, the oil companies, their dream is that you'll drive up to the station and fill up with hydrogen, which they probably take out of oil.
Oh, yeah.
So they're all protected. But you're right. Change like that is always a big deal. Thank God we've got a lot of communication, the Internet. And you can think about that stuff in advance. But we've got to do something eventually. I've said for many years, the only way we're ever going to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict is stop buying their product.
Absolutely.
Put them on welfare. See how they do.
Well, let me tell you, it would be great to have every individual home self-contained with its own power source.
Listen, I firmly believe that's in our future. I get asked all the time about how hard is it to invent things, and I have this little phrase I use a lot, and that is, right now, we are living in the caveman days. Not very much has been invented yet.
There is so much. It's
endless. We're just getting started here. All the easy stuff.
All right, paint a picture for us, Woody, for a moment. Think out. Do it where I think I'm still going to be on this planet. So think out about 20 years from now. What's the planet look like technologically?
Well, first of all, if our religious fanatics don't cause us to annihilate ourselves.
Yeah, let's assume we're here.
Assume, like the cliffhanger movies, we make it by the hair of our chinny chin chin. First of all, I predict right now that within the next 5 to 7 years, we're going to figure out one of the laws of nature that we still have absolutely no concept of what it is.
Gravity?
Gravity.
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine what that's going to do for transportation, for energy efficiency, for not just going to other planets, but for traveling around the world, for traveling on highways? You don't have to worry about maintaining highways. They'll just be like lines on a map.
I wanted to do a Hollywood movie. Think about this now. All of a sudden, something happens to the Earth's gravity, the gravitational field, and everything starts floating. How could we live if everything started to float?
Well, that would be pretty tough if you had no control over it.
None.
You got to have some control. It's kind of like focusing the light again. It's one thing to be able to do it, but if you can't control it, then you're almost back to square one. We get weaker, for one thing, if there's no gravity. That's the resistance against which we build the fact that we got a certain level of average strength amongst us as humans. People that go into space or wherever for a period of time come back and they can hardly stand up.
So does anybody in government come up to you and say, hey, Woody, would you invent this or that?
That's an off-limits subject for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't get to say much about that.
What have I stumbled into?
Well, I mean, I don't see our government as being as sinister as we often see in the movies. And, I mean, if we're going to survive, inventions are going to happen. Technology is going to happen. And if we're afraid of it, what we're doing is laying the foundation for potentially an enemy to do it. And then we play catch-up. So we have to do things first. And the old idea that I think used to prevail of suppress this or suppress that can only go so far, I think, because if we don't do it, we cannot suppress what our enemies may be doing in secret. And so I believe there's a better attitude than there used to be, at least at certain levels within certain parts of our government.
Okay, I won't keep pushing you on that.
Thank you.
At this point. You just let me know first whenever anything happens.
Oh, you'll know about this. It's going to be public.
So I noticed on your website that you look for positions. You have some job openings with the company or what?
The American Technology Corporation is the public company that makes hypersonic sound. By the way, we've been selling it for about 9 months. It's really starting to get some traction right now. In fact, right now we're at a show, a big show in Chicago, and it is unbelievable the applications people are thinking of. Not just creating sound, how about canceling noise?
Canceling noise?
Yeah,
how are you going to do that?
Cancel the noise in the cockpit of an airplane or in the rear of an airplane or in the cabin of a helicopter or your mate next to you snoring. We believe that kind of thing can be done. We use speakers already to cancel noise. Imagine you got in your car, think of this, a set of hypersonic speakers in the front for the passengers in the front, and the kids are in the back listening to a completely different station or playing an arcade game on the DVD that's back there, and they don't hear each other. Or you're in your family room. And
could you theoretically point, let's say there are four people in the car. The driver loves to listen to Coast. The other one loves to listen to music. Another person wants to listen to some sporting event. Could you theoretically have three separate beams in that one car?
Or four or five. Imagine you go into a sports bar where there's 50 televisions, and now you dial in which one you want at your table, and it beams down, bounces off the table. Everyone at your table hears the basketball game. The guy at the next table watches a boxing match. That's
and you don't
real.
Hear it, and you don't hear the boxing match
at all. By the way, this is not the future. This is right now. This stuff is installed. If you're in Washington, D.C., go into the largest McDonald's in the world. It's in the aerospace section of the Smithsonian. They do $1 million a day at this McDonald's, if you can believe it. We're installed there in the check-in lines.
Is this your invention?
Yes.
Good for you.
We're in Las Vegas. We're all over the place. By the way, you didn't ask me about the prize.
Well, that's a $500,000 prize.
I'm giving it away.
You're giving away the prize?
Well, here's what happens. The MIT people gave out the prize. If I accept the prize, I end up giving the feds 35% and the state of California 11%. That's almost half the money.
So what are you going to do with it?
You put it into a nonprofit foundation and you give away college scholarships. You grant money to inventors. And
Woody, you got to help us because I've been talking about setting up an X Prize for alternative energy.
Well, I'm going to do my own alternative energy, but sure, talk to me.
Think about that. Okay, you take care of yourself, my friend.
I appreciate it. It's been a blast.
Oh, what a mind you have. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment with our guest, Jonathan Gray. If Woody Norris lived 2,000 years ago, can you imagine the technology they had? Now, that's what Jonathan Gray's going to talk with us about when we come right back.
Get daily automatic MP3 downloads of tonight's show and every night show with the new Coast to Coast AM podcast. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.